Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dell, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. We've recently started getting queries from investors looking for more defensive exposure in their equity portfolios, and healthcare is an area of particular interest for them. Today, I'm incredibly fortunate to be speaking with Australia's best rated healthcare analyst for over the last 14 years, Andrew Goodsall of MST Marquee. It's an independent research provider. Andrew, thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
So Andrew, can you tell me a bit about the research that you undertake and the areas that you cover?
Sure. I've been examining the healthcare sector as a sell-side equities analyst for almost 20 years now, and specifically looking at the top Australian healthcare companies by market capitalisation. So CSL would be obviously the top of that list, but the key medtech names like Cochlear and ResMed, together with the domestic service providers, which provide hospital and diagnostic and pathology services. So that's, as you say, it is a diverse sector. And specifically, we've found that it's a sector where the transactions don't take place in the public domain. Say, for instance, retail, obviously, you can examine what takes place pretty easily by going to the local shopping centre, but for this sector, there's a layer of complexity we think that sits below the sector that's quite hard to unravel, particularly with some of these names being global. We've been able to develop a very good network of contacts that helps us sort of understand the sector and understand the direction of the sector, and that's been our style.
I would say as a consumer, it's pretty complex to observe from a distance. And then also as an investor, you look at the different names and the sheer range of different services they provide in many cases, or products they provide, can be quite difficult to work through. And if you're not a medical specialist, also understanding the conditions that they treat can be quite challenging.
Exactly. Yes, it does have a lot of complexity, and our job obviously is to try and break that down and help investors navigate their way through the sector, particularly, you know, the latest haemophilia drug and how the trials are progressing. So there is a lot of complexity and I guess a lot of need to understand what's happening on a global basis, particularly with some of the competitors to the Australian companies, which can have a dramatic impact on the stock price from time to time.
That's really interesting. So there's a general perception, and certainly where our queries are coming from, that healthcare is a defensive sector, mm-hmm. that we have a lot of... prices are somewhat inelastic and people are very happy to spend on healthcare when they may be cutting their expenditure somewhere else. Our son needed a number of surgeries when he was very small, and it didn't occur to me until quite some time after it happened, actually, that it had cost us quite a substantial amount of money, but we would have spent 100 times that happily in order to ensure that he was well. Do you feel that concept of defensiveness is fair, or do you need to take a more nuanced view when you look at all the different areas and subsectors?
Sure. We've always felt that is a fundamental underpinning of the sector. But to your point, There is a place for price sensitivity. There is a place for the people who pay for the healthcare. So, for instance, government in this country, but in other countries, it'll be insurers to take some time to examine: are they funding the right levels of care? Is there new opportunities to fund? Is there cheaper opportunities? So, we think there's always going to be some level of risk, particularly around single payer systems, and I'd describe Australia as largely a single payer system where the government is predominantly payer for Medicare services and so on. Obviously, we do have a private health insurance system, and I'll come to that in a moment, but that too is reasonably regulated. So, yeah, the picture that we'd probably build for you is that demographic is a core baseline for this sector. If in particular, we're always very cognizant that the baby boomer generation coming to their health, what I describe as their peak healthcare consumption years, which probably starts
That's a very generous term, is it? Peak healthcare consumption.
It probably, yeah, well, I guess if you look at...
They're getting old, is that what we said?
Definitely, that's right. But if we spend a lot of time just looking at utilisation rates, and if you look at private health insurance, for instance, people aged over 65 would, on average, those with private health insurance spend 4 days per year in hospital.
Wow.
And those under 65 would be 0.7 days. Mm. So it's a bit arbitrary, but it is very clear through all the data that unfortunately we can all expect to use the healthcare system a lot more at sort of age 65 and over. And we see 2020 as quite a significant year for the demographics, because the baby boomers turned 70. Assuming they started in 1950, they turned 70 by 2020. So, that does underpin the sector, but we're very keen to point out to people that, if you look at the downturn in the US economy post the global financial crisis in 2007, 2008, because that system is a largely an employment-based insurance system, unemployment, for instance, was a driver of lower utilisation rates. We do see that there are some reasons to think there's elasticity around utilisation or price, and certainly from a regulator's point of view, we would expect that all astute governments would want to continually revise what they're paying for healthcare.
That's it's very interesting. Yeah, there's the personal issue around what you're willing to pay, but there's also this issue that governments will actually drive most of the decision, certainly in Australia and other countries that have a relatively similar system. So on that, the regulatory risks, I do find private health insurance incredibly interesting. I've always worked pretty closely on the personal tax side, helping people understand their personal tax, and private health insurance had to be included in that decision. Mm. Both the carrot and the stick, you've got a rebate or you've got a surcharge if you don't have the insurance. Mm-hmm. For many people who had, frankly, no desire to have insurance, most Australians would be aware, but maybe not, that premiums are not age-based, so those older people who are 4 days a year in hospital are being heavily subsidised by younger people who are 0.7. So it's, that's a really complex system, but it's had to have a lot of regulation around it just to ensure people took it out in the first place.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. So one of the, I guess, hallmarks of our research style is to understand what's happening in Canberra. And regardless of, which party forms government, we think budget night each May. Although I should
big
note...
Big night for all of us, yeah.
I should note next year it's been brought forward to April. But regardless, we think generally the election cycle, change of government, change of political party are all turning points for healthcare in particular, because obviously stylistically each major party has slightly different policies around healthcare. And what we do see is government, as we mentioned, is always examining, is there opportunities to make savings across the healthcare portfolio? So there's a number of things that are underway at the moment. The current government's initiated a review of the medical benefit schedule, which is going through the schedule fairly fastidiously and trying to understand, are there better ways to do things? Are we funding the wrong levels of care when other types of care should be funded? So that's an ongoing review process. We also would flag that with change of government, the current Labor Party policy would be to cap private health insurance at premium increases to 2% for the next 2 years, and then ask the Productivity Commission to review the arrangements for private health insurance and come up with some initiatives that would allow private health insurance premiums to sustain lower premium increases over a longer period of time. So, we do think that if we were to put our hand on our heart, the current private health insurance system does have some pressure points, and one being that for the average person, but more so for those on a fixed income who might be relying on their own superannuation or their own investment, or even to enhance a pension, or those, as I say, with a fixed income, that as a percentage of household income, their spend on healthcare, but private health insurance, has been going up way faster than, double what their underlying income has been going up. So, you know, these things have created a pressure point where, you know, both sides of politics are looking to sort of understand if they can make some changes. So I guess to come back to the original question and understand, you know, there's just always going to be, healthcare is always going to be a talking point in the community, and the cost of healthcare is fundamental to that. And, you know, we think governments are going to reflect that as well, because they understand that these are pressures that confront families, and particularly people on fixed income who are generally probably going to be heavier users of the system as well.
The proportion of GDP spent on healthcare is substantially higher than the risk always to the to the government budget was always around the age pension, until we realised that was actually not going to be the issue at all. It was actually going to be healthcare with an ageing population. That was where the risk was going to lie.
Yes. Yeah, so there have been some very good reports. The Intergenerational Report previously said that I think by 2050 that the Australian government spending on healthcare would double as a percentage of CPI. So from where it was perhaps 5-6 years ago. So it's Australia, I think, spends something between 10-11% of GDP on healthcare as a country, which compares to the US as an extreme, somewhere above 18-19%. And the OECD average, I think, we're just above the OECD average now. So I think we might still be in sort of right territory. And Australia does enjoy, you know, some very good health outcomes. So we should generally, even though I think it's an Australian pastime to sort of re-examine our healthcare system, I think overall we do have some pretty good health outcomes if we really stand back from it. But
the second longest life expectancy in the world—that's pretty good.
I think so. Depending on where we are against Japan.
Japan's usually pretty flash as well, but.
So I think that's an area we spend a lot of time thinking about. And I guess if you're looking at stocks that do have government exposure, and we think generally government exposure does provide certainty and does provide some strength of investment growth, particularly when government is investing to ensure that there is access and. For this baby boomer generation that I've flagged. Some of the names that are exposed there would be Ramsay's Healthcare. We've got a buy on Ramsay's. Lovely. It's been a little bit weak of recent times, which is part of the reason for our buy call on Ramsay's. But it's gone offshore. Not only is it an Australian hospital operator, which remains the mainstay of their business, but it's now got exposure to the UK, France, and through a recent acquisition, Scandinavia. So we think some of that diversification means that when you do get some things like regulatory change, if that occurs in one jurisdiction, the portfolio effect of being multi-jurisdiction does give you a little bit more certainty and defensive characteristics. Equally, Sonic, where we're a hold rating, it's also now a global provider of pathology and clinical lab services, and it's got that similar portfolio effect. So we think that they're both very good quality stocks that started as domestic providers but have now, to their credit, exported that skill set globally and become really globally leaders in their field. If we would look at global pathology or hospital companies, they're certainly up there.
It's quite powerful to think that little Australian businesses can export these skills to the world, and in something as important as healthcare, that's quite impressive, really.
Well, exactly. Yes, it's sometimes we underestimate, our ability to grow businesses like these. But one fact that I think gets thrown around is that Australia might be a very small percentage of the global population, but I think when it comes to medical research, we're massively overrepresented in peer-reviewed medical journal articles globally. I think it might be a 10-to-1 sort of ratio. So it is really quite a strength of Australia.
Medical research.
Medical research is up there.
So anything from the medical research and the medical technology area that you are most interested in?
Sure. Look, we felt Australia's had a very strong med tech sector because, in particular, it's an area that a small country can do quite well, unlike pharmaceuticals, where generally you have to have an extraordinarily large global pharmaceutical company. MedTech generally can be quite specific and quite focused, and the distribution can be handled by a smaller company. You know, so for instance, I would say to you that Cochlear and ResMed are both terrific examples of Australian MedTech that's been able to take very specific and high technology products to global markets and not have to use distributors or other distributors in most of those markets.
So my father is a technology researcher in the biotechnology field, so he works with plants, not with medical technology, I think because he doesn't like blood very much. But he's always been of the view, he works in the university in Australia, he was always of the view that being so isolated was actually really valuable from a global perspective because you weren't interested in what other people were doing, you didn't even know, and therefore you could develop some very innovative and interesting things in your own little space in Australia and then take it to the world, which I think is quite a cool perspective.
Yes, and I would say to you that whilst we cover ResMed and Cochlear, in the small medtech space, there's some extraordinary innovative companies that are coming through. Some will be listed on the stock exchange, but there's some that are coming through that we're aware of that are developing some really interesting technology in pain management and other areas that, as you say, might be quite niche in their own way, but Australia does have, you know, these quite niche skills, which is sensible for a smaller nation, you know, to focus on what it can do quite well.
It's cool and interesting to think about all of those things. So within Australia and internationally, one thing that I think is quite interesting, a very difficult field to navigate well for consumers, but also for investors, when people come to the healthcare sector, we're talking about those 70 plus or 65 year olds plus, but also at any other stage of your life, you don't come to the healthcare sector for fun. You come to it because you're often in acute pain or something has happened. It's often acute and you have to make a decision very quickly. People find it very difficult to navigate. It, and the informational asymmetries are enormous. You know, your doctor knows a huge amount about your health and you know next to nothing. Mm-hmm. Don't even know what you have when you arrive. Or in my case, we had a child and we had no idea what was going on. That gives companies providing services, technology and services, obviously an incredible opportunity to set prices and create profit. And you talked about how governments are trying to regulate that as best they can. Is there an opportunity for disruption in some of these areas? Your disruption has changed that informational asymmetry a lot in heaps of other sectors and fields. Do you think healthcare might go the same way, or is it still always going to be very much down to a personal relationship between a person and their doctor?
We are seeing some innovation, and as a as an analyst, we're now covering Medibank Private, the health insurer, and they're actually at the forefront of some of these sort of disruptions, particularly allowing consumers to access information the same way that you might access services like TripAdvisor and so on. You know, not quite the same, but they're certainly doing some very innovative work around trying to help consumers understand what it is that what their expectations should be around the cost of the surgery. So they've certainly added that to their web page. They've also added, along with other insurers who are also doing this, directory so that it can help you navigate the system and find a doctor in your area who would specialise in the sort of care that you might need, and also accept a no-gap arrangement, which is important to people to avoid out of pockets and you know, I guess keep their healthcare costs manageable. So we certainly see that coming. It's early days yet, but it's you know, we certainly see that evolving. And within that, they're also building out some optionality around where you get your care. So for instance, they're increasingly going to allow you to take some of your post-operative care, whether it's rehabilitation or other types of care in the home. So That's now available to people who are insured through Medibank. But we think that's something you'll see more generally as a value add from most health insurers, because the bar has been lifted. And we think if you look across the globe, you'll see a trend away from bricks and mortars as the sort of fundamental caregiver to a greater percentage of care delivered outside of a classic hospital setting. And part of the recent acquisition of Ramsay's into Scandinavia is that the company they acquired there, a company by the name of Capio, has a very sophisticated home care service provider and tech and IT to support that. And so I suspect their end game is to ultimately bring that to Australia and being able to do some of that care here. So it's early days, but it is changing. And, this is an international trend away from delivering care that perhaps is better delivered in the home, and particularly if patients are much more comfortable in the home when they can be. So
it's interesting you're talking about big providers trying to make these changes themselves. It's not about a disruptor coming in from another field completely, a technology provider, for example, and disrupting the whole system. It's more about existing players lifting the bar a bit.
Yeah, there's it's probably hard to point to any Uber that's sort of emerged
in
Australia at this stage, but everything. Certainly globally, there's some very innovative things being done. I mean, you probably sort of say that have they become as ubiquitous as Uber at this point? The answer is probably no, but certainly from a technology point of view, healthcare has been a bit slow in terms of adopting technology. But I think, particularly as we go forward, we're going to see technology more and more, at the forefront in terms of how we choose our care, where we choose our care, and how we choose to recuperate and so on. I definitely think there's a lot on the march there. And if we look at the US, which always seems to be, the sort of home of disruptors, you can see some really interesting examples of the hospitals of the future, which are very much smaller than the footprint that hospitals have today.
That's quite interesting.
So these services are starting to allow, services to be delivered outside of that setting.
So I will give you the million-dollar question, because I know all of our investors are very, very interested to know your answer. CSL, where to from here?
Yes, so we've just upgraded to a buy, so it's, the timing is immaculate because simply last Friday we had upgraded to a buy. So the quick background here on CSL, obviously had a stellar result at the full year. The stock performed amazingly well at one point. Pushed well into the $230 per share mark. We're at a hold for the hold rating for the last of that sort of upside. I guess we felt that the stock had met all of our targets, met our expectations in terms of earnings and delivered, but continued to outperform beyond what we thought was the true value. So we have been a hold for a little while. We've recently, if we're a hold, we're obliged, we think, to go and check the marketplace globally to understand, are we missing something? Is there upside above and beyond what we'd forecast? And we've completed that exercise. There's a couple of key conferences in the last few months that look at this plasma sector. This CSL, for listeners who are not familiar with it, it's now a top three company by market capitalization in Australia. And it is in the blood plasma business. That's products that are derived predominantly from the plasma that sits in our blood, which carries our immune system and so on. That's the end of the the technology lesson, but just so that your listeners can understand the uniqueness of this particular company, because there's only three of them globally, and CSL would be, and they dominate 85% of the global market, and CSL would be, probably product by product the largest, and certainly across some of those products, and they have a global footprint and a global sales force, headquartered out of Melbourne, but a CEO that lives in the US because that's the dominant market. But to come back to our buy, we're very comfortable that this story will continue. It's been a terrific growth story for more than 20 years now. Mm. And we think that where the marketplace is at this point in time, the supply of plasma is actually very tight. It's quite difficult to harvest. It's predominantly from paid donors in the US, but because the number of volunteer donors is diminishing, so we think that creates a backdrop for a very tight set of market circumstances. And globally, there's quite a divergence of pricing for the product, which generally is a little unnatural because as it becomes more expensive to collect and attain the product, there is some expectation that those costs will have to be passed on through the price of the product. And we're seeing that a little bit across Europe, which has been a laggard in terms of pricing. So that's coming up a little bit towards US. Long way to go, but a little bit. We think that will continue. But equally, we can see in CSL's portfolio some very highly specialised products as well, particularly for treating rare diseases, which are much better funded globally than they were a couple of decades ago. And these products are unique as, in some cases, being the only products available for people with some very difficult healthcare situations. So CSL continues to do well in that specialty space, and their research and development day is this coming Wednesday, which will be an opportunity for them to showcase the products they might bring to us in the next 5 years. And so I think ultimately, you know, we can see that reinvestment in research and development as sustaining the growth. And so, you know, we do see it as a core portfolio holding is the way we describe it for those invested in the Australian market, because it is, you know, a top 10, top three by market cap company in the Australian market.
And a global leader, which is pretty impressive.
That's right. We do have a few of them. You know, we Cochlear, ResMed and CSL. So Australia does have a few, but at the moment, this is the stock that we would be recommending as our top pick in the marketplace.
That's fantastic. Any other tips for our listeners while we're here?
So we've also carrying a buy on ResMed. We believe ResMed is equally on the cusp of expanding its marketplace over the next 5 to 10 years. They've recently made an acquisition of a company in the US that is dominant in the home care provision space, which we've talked about. This is an IT company that allows ResMed, we think, perhaps on a five-year view, to expand the range of products that they have offered. Classically, they've been renowned for the leader in continuous positive airway pressure, CPAP, which treats obstructive sleep apnea. That's been their core product. But we're seeing this acquisition as allowing to branch out more broadly in the respiratory space. And so our longer term view is that this will be the platform from which they will grow their business into greater care in the home around respiratory care, from people who might need some breathing assistance to people with who actually need portable oxygen concentrators just to get through their day. So yeah, we see this as a longer journey. Just like CSL, they're investing for the longer term. And so they would be our top picks, which both global stocks. We're a little bit reluctant to, particularly with some of the domestic healthcare policy changes that might come with a change of government. We're a little bit wait and see around how that evolves. Although, having said that, we mentioned that we think the system will evolve for the positive if we can get positive changes and reforms. But, for your listeners today, I'm going to leave you with CSL and ResMed.
Thank you so much. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. We hope it has been helpful for you in your journey to creating wealth. We always love to hear from you, so if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.